可愛いよ。Okay, folks. How was your break? No, nobody can hear me. Okay. Testing. They changed the sound system, so usually when I whack this, it comes out louder. Okay, folks. Everybody up here. Okay, how was your break? Mine was really long. I left the day after your corporate finance project was done, which was May something, and I've been doing nothing for 7 months. Yeah. But it's good to see. Before I get started, it's working, it's just you guys are too loud. Actually, last week on Wednesday, I started teaching last week because the undergraduate classes start a week earlier because they get more value for their money. They have two extra sessions. Yeah. They keep compressing this class. You know, when I first started teaching at Stern, a typical valuation class lasted 30 sessions. They keep chipping away 1 week here, hoping you don't notice and that you don't care. Soon it'll be down to 2 weeks and you won't even know because it'll have happened incrementally. Last Wednesday, though, when I started teaching the class, the sound system had a catastrophic failure, which means it wasn't just the mic that wasn't working. The sound system blew up. So I had to spend 70 minutes on just talking louder. And I told them, look, I'm not coming back Monday if you don't fix the sound system. So they got a new sound system in, which presumably is better than the old sound system, but it also is less sensitive to my whacking the mic. Because it used to be felt like the big sound. So I'll have to figure out something, gong or something to get your attention. But a lot of familiar faces. How many of you are in my corporate finance class last? So you know what's coming. The torture will begin shortly. So you know what's coming. How many of you are not MBA 2s? Not MBA 2s, right? Okay. The reason I asked is, of course, one of the things you need to do is create a group, and if you're not an MBA 2, that gets a little more difficult because you don't know as many people. And as with the corporate finance class, the orphan list is now open. Those of you who are not in my corporate finance class, you know how it goes, right? You're one of those lost, abandoned souls that nobody knows and you don't know anybody. Go to the orphan list and put yourself up for adoption. And one of the best case scenarios is you get five orphans together, you have a group. It's called the orphan group. It sounds a little pathetic, eh? But no, orphan groups actually do very well. So if you go to the website for the class, there's a little link to the orphan list so you can put your name down. And in fact, the email that I'll send after the class, you thought I was going to stop sending emails? Not going to happen. Eh? We'll include the orphan list link as well. So everybody should be able to get by. So let's get started. I came to NYU in September of 1986. I'm getting old. In fact, you know, I'm getting so old, there are people whose kids are coming back to school. Really, your mother was in my class? Your grandmother was in my class? Not quite grandmother level yet. Right? When I came to NYU in 1986, they gave me a class to teach. It was a class called Security Analysis. You guys heard of this class? It's a class with a very long tradition. It was taught in the 1950s at Columbia by a guy called Ben Graham. Must not have been a very good teacher, to be quite honest. He had only five students. But one of the nice things about teaching is you're always blessed by the students you have. And his most famous student, of course, was, come on, he who shall not be named, the Voldemort of finance. You know who I'm talking about, Warren Buffett. So this is a class that's been taught a long time. They give it to me in 1986. I took one look at the class, and I went to the head of the department and said, I don't want to teach this class, most boring class ever. Not a great attitude for an assistant professor to take right after you've been hired, right? So he said, what would you like to teach instead? I said, I'd like to teach evaluation class. He said, don't do it. There isn't enough stuff in valuation to fill a class. And you know what? He was absolutely right. In 1986, there wasn't enough stuff in valuation to fill a class. There were really no books on valuation unless you wanted to go back to security analysis that was a 50-year-old book written by Ben Graham. There were no classes on valuation that filled a whole class. People, no, when I did my MBA, my valuation lasted 2 sessions in one class. But I really, really, really wanted to teach this class. And I discovered very early in my academic life that if you want to get something done at a university, the best way to get it done is to do it subversively. Because if you try to get official permission, you know what would happen, right? A committee would be formed. You guys have experience with committees being formed? They meet and they meet, they forget what they're meeting about, they keep meeting, then they have baby committees that they call subcommittees, and they meet, you know, they interact with each other. It becomes very incestuous. They have no idea what they're doing. 35 years later, they might come back and say, you can teach this class, but I'd have been ready to retire. So I said, okay, I'll teach your damn security analysis class. There was no damn, I was polite, and no, your security, blank security analysis class. And I walked in and taught evaluation class. They have no idea what I do in a classroom. Remember, these were the days before you had cameras in the classroom. You closed the doors. I could teach cooking for 15 weeks. And if everybody got an A, nobody complained. I could have coasted. You know how long it took them to catch on? In 2008, I get a call from the dean's office. So we hear you're teaching evaluation class. I said, yes, I've been doing it for 22 years. They say, we don't see it anywhere in the course listing. I said, that's easy to explain. I've been hijacking all these other classes you've been giving me and teaching valuation instead. For 12 years, you made me teach an equity, instruments, and markets class. I'm not in the least bit interested in markets or instruments or even equity, which doesn't leave me much to teach. It's just and. So I taught valuation instead. They said, that's not right. We should call it valuation. I said, I agree. So if you look at the NYU schedule, valuation shows up for the first time in 2008, and the market crashed right away. So maybe there's some correlation between the two. But last spring, when I came back to teach valuation, that was my 55th semester teaching this class. And I'm going to say something about this class that's going to encapsulate how I think about valuation and how I'm going to teach this class. Everything I know about valuation, I've learned in the course of teaching this class. Notice how I phrased it. I didn't know it before I walked in. I remember the first semester I taught this class in 1986. My syllabus went 5 weeks. The course lasted 15 weeks. People said, hey, how come you're only 5 weeks in the syllabus? I said, that's all I can think of right now. So what happens after week 5? I said, we'll find out, right? Maybe we'll have nothing left to do and we'll learn cooking for the remaining 10 weeks. Because think of, even in my limited lifetime teaching this class, how much has happened. In 1987, I was teaching this class, and at that time, the graduate school was downtown, right next to the American Stock Exchange. In fact, it's now the New York Public School or something, that building. And my office overlooked the street, over Rector Street. I remember coming out October 19th of 1987, and looking out of my window, and everybody from the floor of the exchange was on the street. I thought maybe a fire alarm went off. And it turned out that October 19th of 1987 was a one-day crash. The S&P 500 dropped 22% in one day. 22% in one day. Think about what that would look like if it happened today. Shanghai dropped 9% yesterday, so you can start to think about, hey, twice that plus more. And guess what? The day after, I had class, and what did people ask about? They asked about the crash. They said, how can stock prices change that much in one day? How can values change that much in one day? And I had to talk about it. Then you got to the 1990s, and you had the e-commerce revolution. You had PayPal and eBay and Amazon. And I had no choice. You had to talk about those companies in the 1990s. How does a company, which is a young company with small revenues and big losses, become a valuable company? And I had to talk about valuing young companies, the dot-com companies. Then you got to 2000, 2001, you got the correction. And people said, well, will a dot-com company be ever worth money again? And it would revisit that same discussion from the other side and say, hey, why would you attach value to a company when the entire business seems to have imploded? In 2008, of course, you got the banking crisis, where markets across the world kind of went into a tailspin. Everything we'd ever thought about diversification went out of the window, right? Because what was the lesson? If you diversify and you hold global stocks and bonds and currencies, you're going to be okay. And in 2008, you weren't. And people said, well, what went wrong? And we had to talk about that. And then you get to the last decade, and we had to talk about Facebook and LinkedIn and the rise of the social media companies. I wasn't teaching in the fall, but if I'd been teaching in the fall, guess what we'd have to talk about? We'd have to talk about WeWork and how an investor we thought was a smart investor. Because in the middle of 2019, if I talked to you about Masa Son and SoftBank, what was the conventional wisdom? The guy's a visionary genius. He knows what he's doing. Think of how quickly the conventional wisdom had changed with WeWork. In fact, the fall would have been a fun time to teach the class. It's never not a fun time, because I valued WeWork in September and Aramco in November. How many chances in your life do you get to value an IPO that overnight becomes the most valuable company in the world? Right? $1.7 trillion market cap. Now, we can debate where the value comes from, but we'd have valued Aramco and WeWork. This is a pragmatic class, which means for the next 5 months, there will be surprises, good ones and bad ones. And we'll have to talk about it in class. There's a reason I've never, ever used a case study in my life. It sounds absurd. At 43,000 live case studies plus new ones getting added in, why would I want to go back to 1988 and talk about some stupid company doing some stupid thing then so we can say that was a stupid thing to do? That Time Warner AOL is a case study. Who looks at that case and says, oh, Time Warner did the right thing? Act like you don't know what. How do you do that? The nice thing about live experiments is they're exciting. The bad thing about live experiments is you don't control the outcome. But that's okay. So I don't know what we'll talk about all through the next 15 weeks, but one of the things we're going to talk about in this class is what's happening out there. How do we explain them through the lens of valuation? So every one of these classes, and this is the part which is different from corporate finance, here's what the class will start with. It'll start with a quiz of what we're going to cover during the class. That sounds a little backwards, right? And the reason I do that is I want to show you that you can reason your way to the answer we're going to get in the class anyway. Nothing here is rocket science. So we'll start with today's quiz. I didn't even put it down on paper because it's such a straightforward quiz. Here's the question. First question. Is valuation an art or a science? Think about it for a moment. Is it an art or a science? Okay. And then I'm going to ask for a show of hands, and then we'll come back and talk about this in the session today. How many of you think it's a science? Okay. How many of you think it's an art? How many think it's magic? Okay. We'll come back and talk about it, because this is at the core of so many frustrations in valuation. Is if you miscategorize it, you're going to be doing stuff that never makes sense. So we'll talk about it. Here's my second question. This is a personal question. There's no right answer to it. It's a question I asked you a different version of in the corporate finance class. If I asked you to classify yourself as a human being, would you classify yourself as a number cruncher or a storyteller? What comes more easily to you, working with numbers or telling stories? Don't look at your neighbor. This is about you. You think, how would I know? You've known for a very long time. I'll tell you when I knew. I knew when I was about 12 years old. I wasn't a prodigy, but it was right after my first English literature class. I was asked to read Moby Dick, and I did. I was a good kid. came ready for a discussion of whales and captains the next day. And I discovered about 30 minutes into the session that nobody was talking about the whales or the captain. So I put up my hand and said, when are we going to talk about the whale? And I remember what the instructor said. She said, there's no whale. I said, what, did I read the wrong book? I distinctly remember a big fish going all the way through this book. She said, it's a metaphor. My jaw dropped. And the rest of the class was about hidden meanings in things I didn't even know had a meaning in the first place. I remember coming out of that class with a singular conclusion. I said, never again am I going to subject myself to that kind of bullshit. And the rest of my high school life was laid out for me. I avoided this fuzzy literature classes like the plague. It was Algebra 1, Algebra 2, Algebra 3 out of high school. And these were the good old days. You know what happened in the good old days? You didn't have core curriculums in colleges. You know what the core curriculum is, right? For the first 2 years of college, you're made to take all these classes you don't want to take. Why do I need to take that history class? It's to get a rounded education. They're lying to you. It's to keep the history department employed, but they can't tell you that. But in those days, you could take numbers class, numbers degree, accounting, engineering, mathematics, and then you got a numbers job. How many of you are numbers people? Okay. And your numbers job, your banker, engineer, accountant. Why are you back here? Because you discover about 5 years into a numbers job how incredibly boring it is to keep entering numbers into spreadsheets. You're done with it. You're back in business school. Let's go back to that literature class. There were people who loved this hidden meaning stuff. They lap it up. They're the poets. They're like my youngest son. He writes poetry. He showed me his first poem. I don't think he's going to show me anymore. He said, Dad, what do you think? I said, Kieran, this is very impressive, but aren't the last words supposed to rhyme? That's the way I think about poetry, right? Nursery rhymes. I kind of got stuck in nursery rhymes. I've never got past it. And I remember the look of contempt he gave. He said, Dad, you'll never be a poet. I said, you're right. And he took Literature 1, Literature 2, Literature 3, graduated from high school, went on to become history majors at Yale, and graduated from Yale and discovered that even Yale history majors don't get paid very much. So after about 5 years of poverty-stricken wages, what do? You quit, you come back in business school. How many of you are more naturally storytellers? Oh, you might not have a poverty streak. Don't take the poverty-stricken part. I made a lot of money. That's okay. You can be a storyteller who made a lot of money. Congratulations. But there are number crunches. Who do you think has the advantage in this class? The number crunches or the storytellers? We'll come back and talk about it, because you think about valuation, you think it's all numbers, spreadsheets, models, equations. So let's get the process rolling. The administrative stuff, you know how to find me. I'm in KMEC 969. The only thing is I keep going back and forth to sunny climates, so I might not be there on a Thursday afternoon, because yesterday I left San Diego. It was 75 and sunny, and I landed in New York this morning. It was 35 and cold. I almost got around and went back saying, class, who cares? You know, I'm going to skip the class now. But I'm here most of the next 15 weeks. If you want to get me, the easiest, the cleanest and the quickest way to get a response is through my email. My homepage, we'll come back and talk about pretty much everything you need for this class, is on there. Mondays and Wednesdays, the office hours are structured around the three classes I teach. But I'm around Tuesdays, I'm around late in the day, so if you want to drop by, it's a fair game principle. If you remember, if you find me, I'm fair game. So I take the stairs, I try to go to, go to toilets somewhere else, et cetera, et cetera. But if you find me, I'm fair game. So your job is to find me, my job is to keep away. We'll see how this game goes. You probably know both the TAs for this class, Luisa and Nufal, but they've taken both the corporate finance and the valuation classes. They will be running review sessions starting next week, and I will send you the specifics of it because you have to sign up. There's a Google Shared spreadsheet, partly because there are only 60 people who fit in the room. And what they will do is the problems from past quizzes, because I will not work through problems in class. It's not what I want to do. It's not what you should want me to do. It's a waste of your time and my time. But still, you need the mechanics, especially if you're troubled by, hey, I still want to work through the mechanics. The review sessions are the place to get them. Okay? So let's start with the first question. Is valuation a science or an art? Let's start with that question. Let's take that first question, valuation of science. Let me make it a simpler question. Is mathematics a science? It's your only pure science. In fact, mathematicians are convinced that the rest of us are imposters. And what is it about mathematics that makes it a science? Anybody? What is it about mathematics that makes it a science? What do you think it is? It's absolutes, right? What's 2 plus 3? It's not a trick question. Let's get this all out of the way before we do valuation. 2 plus 3 is 5. Whether I count my left hand, my right hand, a calculator, a computer, North Pole, South Pole. There's no maybe 5, it could be 5. It's absolute. You get the inputs right, you get the output right. If you get the output wrong, you must have done something wrong in the inputs, right? Well, literature should not be working with numbers. So basically, stay away from numbers because you say it might be 5. It is 5, right? So if you want to bring literature in, stick with literature. The whale is a metaphor. I can't disprove it. But 5, I can disprove. Yeah, 5. Right? Mathematics. Physics is mostly a science, right? So we all went up to the 9th floor, got one of those windows open. I don't think you can, but let's say you can. And we all jumped out. I'm not making any collective suicide suggestions, so don't take this literally. We don't fall in the order of our IQs, or where we are in the corporate hierarchy, or what we know about valuation, we just fall. The laws of physics are the laws of physics. The laws of gravity are the laws of gravity. Physics is mostly a science. But in the essence of a science, you get the inputs right, you get the output right, does valuation have a chance of ever becoming a science? What's the question I'm asking? Day before yesterday, I sat down to value Casper. Not the ghost, but the mattress company. Why the IPO is coming up and there's all these numbers being thrown around. I did my best. I did my best. Why? Well, what business are they in? Have you read the prospectus? What business they say they were in? They're in the sleep business. I'll leave that kind of untouched for the moment. They're the mattress business. So I made my best estimates of the mattress business, the market share they would get, the fact that they make a foam mattress that's just like the Lisa foam mattress and 3 other mattresses, so the product is undifferentiated. The fact that they don't even make their own mattresses. Do you know that? They use a manufacturer who also makes the mattresses for Lisa and the other foam manufacturers. So there are all these tricky things I do. But I made my best estimates. I came up with a value for the equity of about 600 to 700 million. So I think I did everything I could with the data I had to make my best estimates. But does it mean the 620 million or 750 million that I got is right? It's my value given my estimates. Tomorrow something could happen and that could go to 900 or 400, and I'm okay with that. Valuation, you can get every single input right, given the data you have and everything you know out there, and still be horribly wrong. And it's not your fault. Valuation can never be a science. And this, I think, is the flaw when accountants talk about fair value accounting. The problem with fair value accounting is they think they can make it a science the accounting way, which is what? Let's write more rules. If we make more rules, it will become scientific. No, it won't, because this can never be a science. So let's get that out of the way. Evaluation can never be a science. So it must be an art, right? Is painting an art? No, I'm not talking about painting your house. You know, the paintings, I'm talking about the ones that hang in the mat. Obviously, it's an art. I still remember taking my oldest son, he's now 30, and he was 8 years old, to the Met for a Picasso exhibit. And we come out 30 minutes later. That's how long an 8-year-old lasts in a museum. And I said, Ryan, what did you think? He said, Dad, I was not impressed. I said, what do you mean you weren't impressed? It's a Picasso exhibit. He said, this guy can't get the nose in the right place. And it's true, right? You look at Picasso, the nose comes out of the side of the head. It's almost like he was drugged or drunk, which, given Picasso's history, is probably both. But we've all gathered together and decided Picasso is special. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The essence of an art is you really cannot teach it. You can teach the mechanics. You can paint by the numbers and create your own abstract art, but I can guarantee you nobody's paying $200 million for that. thank God valuation is not an art, or wasted 35 years of my life trying to teach something that cannot be taught. So it's not a science and it's not an art. What the heck is it? I'll give you the word I used to describe it. It's a craft. Cooking is actually not a bad analogy. How do you master cooking? You could do what my daughter does. She watches the Food Network 16 hours a day. Chopped episode after chopped episode. She can tell you in the abstract how to make a souffle. But God help you if she has to make the souffle. You don't learn cooking by watching TV. You don't learn cooking by reading cookbooks. You learn cooking by cooking. And the first time you cook, what happens? Fire alarms go off. And you got to eat out. But you learn some very important lessons. You learn cooking by doing. You learn valuation by doing. And I have some bad news for you. For the next 15 weeks, Mondays and Wednesdays, 1:33, you can say wasted time. You know why? Because you're going to listen to me talk about valuation. You want to learn valuation, your job starts after I'm done. It turns out that you will learn about valuation when you value companies. And I'm going to try to give you a chance to value as many different kinds of companies as you can. You know why? If all you cook is noodles, you get really good at cooking noodles, but if I ask you to make a soup, say, I don't know how to do that. If all you value are tech companies and ask you to value utility or an oil company, say, I can't do that. So here's what I'm going to do each week, and this is completely optional. You can go along with me, or you can just say, I don't have the time to do it. Every week, I'm going to put up what's called a valuation of the week. Sounds fancy, but I'm going to pick a company to value. What company? Something I'm interested in. It's all about me anyway. I'm going to put up the valuation. I'm going to put a little write-up on why I did the valuation that I did. Then I'm going to invite you to value the company. And I'm going to create a Google Shared spreadsheet and put your numbers in. You know what the company for tomorrow is? Tesla. Why? This is like either watching a train wreck happen or a rocket take off, depending on which perspective you have. It's a company I valued last Thursday, and if you go to my blog, you'll see I have a history with Tesla, some of it good, some of it bad, always getting feedback in very strange ways from either Tesla fans or Tesla haters. But I'm going to put up my valuation of Tesla tomorrow, and this was from last week, so it's after the earnings report came out. The full report hasn't been filed yet with the SEC, but the earnings call was last Monday. Or last Wednesday, I think, because I valued the company on my flight back to San Diego. So I'll put that up, and I'll put up a Google Shared spreadsheet, and I'd like you to value the company. What's your first reaction? It's the first week of class. We haven't done anything yet. Just do what you can. You know what will happen? Many of you will take my spreadsheet and change the third decimal on the risk-free rate, and you will find that your value is very close to mine. That's okay. Next Monday, I'll put up a histogram of what you found, and there'll be one big column around my valuation. That's okay, too. Next week, I'm going to pick a different company. Maybe you'll do Aramco again. Very different company. And the week after, I might do PZ Cousins Nigeria, Nigerian consumer. I'm going to go around the world trying different companies, and you can go along and try your hand and see what you... And here's how I know the class will be working. As we go week by week, guess what you're going to see happening in that Google Shared spreadsheet? First, there'll be fewer people actually doing the valuation. That always happens. But there'll also be more divergence. You will feel much more comfortable disagreeing with me. That is good. The essence of valuation is we have to agree to disagree. But if you can try your hand, you're going to get very different companies to value, and you're going to get a chance to think about building the craft. But the essence of a craft, though, also, is you never quite master it. And I have to remember that, because sometimes I think I have something nailed down, and I get a reminder that I don't. So one of the things I'm going to talk about in this class are things I do differently because I got a reminder. Reminder from somebody, reminder from the market, say, that's not working. So I'm going to talk about how to value users, something that I started doing in 2017 because I valued Uber, and I got pushback from somebody saying, this is 20th century technology on a 21st century company. My first reaction was, what the hell are you talking about? So you can't do, you're valuing the company from the top down, revenues, earnings, which is the way we've always been. But the companies of today build their value by having lots of users, lots of subscribers, lots of members. We should be valuing a user, a subscriber. And after I thought about it, I said, you have a point. And I spent 2 weeks thinking about how would you value an Uber rider? The most productive 2 weeks I've spent in the last 3 years, because that architecture I created, I used to value a Netflix subscriber, an Amazon Prime member, a Spotify subscriber. But I had to leave the door open saying, the things I can learn still. So one of the things I will do is when I had to go back and say, this is, you know, the way I value banks now is very different from the way I used to value them pre-2008. And I'm going to show both the pre and the post. Not because I have the final answer, but I want you to think about, hey, when there's an established way of doing things, is there a different way we can do it? Second, this is a class about valuation. Not valuing publicly traded companies, not valuing large companies, not valuing money-making companies, but valuing any type of asset. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to value companies across the life cycle. We're going to value young companies, mature companies, and the most depressing of all, declining companies. When you value JCPenney, you feel like taking a shower 3 times after you're done because you feel so out of sorts. But somebody's got to value the brick and mortar companies out there which are going under, right? So we're going to value the disruptors and the disrupted. And I think we spend so much time talking about the disruptors that we're really not talking about the disrupted. So when you want to, everybody's valuing Tesla, right? Nobody's talking about how do you value a GM or a Ford given the fact that the game is changing. So we're going to value companies across the life cycle. We're going to value emerging market companies and developed market companies. We're going to value private businesses and public companies. We're going to value companies from the outside in. Sounds fancy as investors, but we're going to also value the companies from the inside out. As managers valuing a company, what's different? What information do you have? We're going to value companies as venture capitalists, private equity investors. By the end of this class, I hope that if you're given a company, no matter what it is, you have the tools to be able to value the company. And there's no company that said, look, no, that valuation doesn't apply there. Third, I'm going to draw a contrast between two words that we very casually interchange in finance. And I blame both academia and practitioners for it. You know what the two words are? Value and price. You know what drives value? Cash flows, growth, and risk. That's always been true. Today, we might use a discounted cash flow model to estimate value. But that 14th century Venetian glassmaker, when he sold his business, based it on cash flows. In fact, it was based more on cash flows then than now because you didn't have this accounting earnings crap confusing the issue. It's cash in, cash out, growth and risk. We know what drives value. You know what drives price? Demand and supply. What drives demand and supply? Mood, momentum. A virus. And people say, how can value change that much in one day? 9% drop in value. You know what? When we talk about price, anything can happen at any point in time. The reason I draw the contrast is the tools to value business, you can use a discounted cash flow valuation, trying to bring cash flows, growth, and risk. You know what tools you need to price something? You need to see what other people are paying for similar things, and you put a number. When you buy a house, you're not valuing the house, you're pricing the house. When you go on StubHub and get a ticket to the Knicks, somebody should be paying you to go watch them, but no, it's a different issue. You don't say, what's the intrinsic value of this seat? You look to see what people are demanding as a price. You price things. And the reason I'm going to draw this distinction is 90% of what passes for valuation out there. You know, out there, investment banks, consulting firms, when people, they're talking about pricing. So somebody asked me when WeWork collapsed how Goldman Sachs priced or put a number, $65 billion was their number for WeWork. So how did they come up with it? What kind of discounted cash flow? And I had to tell them, look, they're not using a discount. They're pricing WeWork. And what did they base the $65 billion on? The fact that the most recent pricing was $47 billion and the person doing the pricing was a smart investor. You say, well, if a smart investor pays $47 billion, a not-so-smart investor should pay $65 billion. You say, this is so unsophisticated. Hey, but pricing is pricing. It's demand and supply, mood and momentum. So overnight, can the pricing change? Yes, if the mood shifts and the momentum shifts, the $65 billion can become $8 billion, and you can't really blink an eye. So one of the things I'm going to talk about are tools for valuation, but tools for pricing as well. Because I think we ignore pricing in classes. We spend all our time on discounted cash flow models. You get out there and you have a pricing job. And you say, what the heck do I do now? This, none of this stuff is working. So I'm going to talk about pricing from the perspective, let's do it better. Because there's nothing inherently good or bad about one or the other. It's just different how you attach a number to it. Now let's talk about the stories and numbers. Now I asked you that question about a storyteller or number cruncher. And the reason I did that is by itself, each school of thought, whether you're a number cruncher or a storyteller, has its weaknesses, right? As a storyteller, I'll tell you what my weaknesses are. My weakness is first the danger of precision. You know what the danger of precision is? When in doubt, what do number crunchers do? They add more decimals. It makes them feel more comfortable. You feel if you get a number to a 6th decimal point, it must be more precise. A complete delusion, but you start to go down that path. The second is the delusion of being objective. You say, I'm a number cruncher. I'm just, the numbers are all I use. This is the danger of big data, right? What's the sales point? Oh, big data will make you objective. I worked with data for a long time. You know what? I can make data sing all kinds of tunes depending on my agenda. Big data is just big data. The way you use it can reflect your agenda. So the fact that you are number cruncher doesn't make you objective. And the third is the delusion of being in control. You think because you put a number on something, you control it. Look at all those banks that thought because they had a value at risk measured at the end of every day that nothing bad was going to happen to them. Complete delusion, but that's what happens when you hang out with other number crunchers. If you're a storyteller, your delusions are different. Your delusions are, if you tell a big story, you think you deserve a big number. Look, I told you a big story. It should be worth at least $10 billion, right? You think you and only you can be creative. Some of you have worked at companies where they're the creative side and the numbers side. You know how the two feel about each other. If you're a numbers person, you are like a leper in that company. Don't come near me. You might contaminate my creative thinking. And you love the power of anecdotal evidence. You're like my mother-in-law. And I don't mean that as a compliment. She comes up with the most outrageous statements, and I always fall into the trap of saying, Judy, how the heck do you come up with this? I remember about 15 years ago, we're sitting at dinner, and out of the blue, it's in the East Coast, you know, I was in New Jersey, and it was snowing outside, and she, out of the blue, she says, the best car to drive in a snowstorm is a Volkswagen Bug. I said, what? You know the Volkswagen Bugs, right? They weigh like 300 pounds. They have a motorcycle engine in the back. You know, it's not exactly the car you think of. It's not a Land Rover. I said, what? A Volkswagen Bug? How do you come up with this? This is how I fall into the trap, because she proceeded to tell me. She said, 15 years prior, she was in Lake Tahoe. I can see the train coming at me down the tracks. Nothing I can do to get out of it. Right? She'd driven to the grocery store in a Volkswagen Bug, and it was snowing. And then she turned around and went back home 3 miles, and she made it back home, and there were 2 other cars that did not. I say, so? She said, that kind of proves it, right? I made it home, they didn't. A Volkswagen, amazing, sample size of 1. How much you can extrapolate from this? You hang out with other storytellers, though? This is the way you tell each other stories? Oh, that proves that, that proves that. And by the time you've proved the entire universe, you know the problem we live in? We live in a world where we hang out with people who think like we do. You go to work in an investment bank, you hang out with other number crunchers. You go to a VC, they're telling stories to each other, and the story gets bigger and bigger, and nobody steps in. Okay. One of the links I sent you in the emails you haven't been reading is the one I wrote on Brunelleschi's Dome. Okay. Those of you familiar with Brunelleschi's dome, it's that amazing dome in Florence, you know. And the amazing thing about the dome is it was the largest freestanding dome in the world. It was built, of course, designed and put together and built by Brunelleschi, a guy who had absolutely no training in architecture, construction, engineering. He was an artist, but he taught himself enough of those disciplines that he could do it. We need No, so when you think about number crunching in storytelling, I think if all you are a number cruncher and you turn in numbers, if all you have are numbers in a spreadsheet, you don't have a valuation. You have a financial model. This class is not a modeling class. I have zero interest in doing something like training the street and say, let's go line item. You will not see me open an Excel spreadsheet for the next 15 weeks because that's not what this class is about. It's not a class about entering numbers into spreadsheets. If all you have is a story, you don't have a valuation, you have a story. A good valuation is a bridge between stories and numbers. Let me be very explicit about what I mean by a bridge. You show me a valuation of a company, let's say Casper, and you show me revenues of $2 billion in year 10. And I ask you, why are your revenues $2 billion in year 10? And the answer I don't want to hear is, it's because I used a 30% growth rate for the first 5 years and 25% thereafter. That tells me absolutely nothing. I want to know your story for Casper that can allow it to have $2 billion in revenues in the mattress business. Maybe you have a story where they're not just in mattresses, they're in pillows, they're in whatever else, travel gear, whatever. But I need to hear your story. So, okay, that makes sense. Every number in your valuation has to have a story attached to it, and every story that you tell me about a company has to have a number attached to it. Like what? You tell me your company has great management. What does that even mean? Where is it showing up in your numbers? You tell me your company has a brand name. Every company claims to have a brand name. Where does it show up? Every story, it's not easy, but it's something you have to force yourself to do. Play to your weak side. And I say that from experience, because from the first 5 years that I taught valuation, I taught it like a number cruncher did, which is, when in doubt, I put up an equation. If I was still doubtful, I put up a second equation. If I was still a little queasy, I made them simultaneous equations. It did absolutely nothing, but it made me feel better. It's only around the fifth and sixth year I realized I didn't have much connection to my value. I was just collecting numbers. And I knew that I had to teach myself how to tell stories. And I had to teach myself. The first time I did it was as painful as the first time I cooked. Fire alarms went off. I had to go outside. But one of the things I'm going to talk about is the process by which I go from a story to a valuation. Okay? I'll use Uber in 2014, but pretty much every valuation I do, one of the things I'm going to try to do is say, this is the story I'm telling about the company. And I'm going to keep emphasizing, well, this is my valuation of Uber. This is my, not because I somehow want to claim that this is the right, but this is my valuation, which means your story looking at Uber can be very different from my story. And your valuation can be different from mine. Who am I to say I have the right value and you do? You don't. So one of the things I want you to work on is whatever side you're uncomfortable with, I want you to work on that side. And finally, this is a class where I want to take action. I'll tell you something. I don't value companies because I'm intellectually curious. I don't lie awake and say, I wonder what Facebook is worth right now. Maybe you do. But if you do, I'd suggest some psychological counseling. When I do valuation, I do it for one reason and one reason alone, which is I want to act on my valuation. Sounds obvious, right? You know how difficult it is to actually act on your valuations? Because to act on your valuations, first, what do you have to have? You have to have faith. Notice the word I use, faith, that you value the company. Why faith? What's the essence of faith? If you ask me to prove that my value is right, I can't do it. This is my value. I have faith in my value. And what's the other thing you have to have faith in? How do you make money? You buy something, you find something that's undervalued, you buy it. And what has to happen for you to actually make money? The price has to, you have to have faith that the price. Why faith? Because again, I can't prove it. So if you ask me, if I do everything right in intrinsic valuation, am I going to make money? And my answer is, I have no idea. And you have to be okay with it. And some of you never will. That's okay. There are index funds out there. You don't have to. You can live perfectly fulfilling lives without valuation being a central part of your life. Trust me. Right? So it doesn't mean that. So if you don't have faith, it's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It just means you're being realistic, saying, look, I don't feel. You can value companies, but you don't have enough faith. You can still work in valuation because other people are pulling the trigger. What do you care? Right? But for you to use valuation to act, you need faith. And I know I can't endow you with my faith, but I will talk about not just where my faith comes from, but when it gets tested. And it'll happen in real time. Like I sold my Tesla last week at 640. It was a good ride. I'm not complaining. But it could go to 800 in the next 2 months. You see how this is your test of faith? Which is, what do you sell? Do you have faith? And it's worse when you buy something which you think is undervalued and it keeps dropping. The bottom doesn't seem to get hit. Again, your faith is getting tested, and you have to be okay with it, because if you say my faith is absolute, that's not faith, that's dogma. It's one reason I'm uncomfortable with what happens in Omaha every year. You know what happens in Omaha every year? They're investing Woodstock, that thousands of people come to listen to two geriatric old men talk to each other about investing. They're great investors. I'm not saying that Buffett and Munger are not worth listening to, but I've been going to Omaha, not to the annual meeting, but to talk to the portfolio manager there. And it's a scary place because you have true believers. You have people who say, I have the answer. That's not faith, that's dogma. Okay? And investing, you got to have faith, which means you have to be willing to say, maybe I'm wrong. And that's completely okay with having faith. So a little bit about the structure for the class. First couple of sessions, I'm going to lay out the big picture. The next 9 sessions or so, I'm going to take all the stuff from corporate finance you've forgotten and remind you again. So those of you in my corporate finance class, some of this is going to be reviewed, risk-free rates, betas, equity risk premiums, but it's never wrong to review basic stuff like that. And if you weren't, I'm going to get you up to speed. And along the way, we'll probably expand on what we talked about with each of those. Now, how do you get a risk-free rate in a currency where nobody has issued bonds in that currency? What if you wanted an Egyptian pound risk-free rate? Or a Venezuelan bolivar risk-free rate? That's kind of a scary thought that should keep you awake. Yeah. Then we will spend but one of the things that will happen during those sessions is you're going to get impatient because I'm not going to value a single company all the way through. I might take pieces of companies. This is the cost of capital for some company. Embraer in 2004, this is how I'd compute cost of debt. But you're going to see bits and pieces. When are we going to get to valuation? Have patience, because for about 4 sessions, all we're going to do is value company after company after company. We're probably going to value 30 companies, ranging the spectrum. We're going to value markets. We're going to value young companies, old companies. And we're going to spend 4 sessions on it. And along the way, we're going to go on the dark side. Trust me, it's not that scary. The dark side of valuation is valuing companies that are difficult to value. This is why you take the class. If all you were doing is valuing money-making companies with a lot of history, this class would last 15 minutes, and then we'd be done. Because anybody can value a money-making company with a lot of history. In fact, I don't even think you need a body to value it. You could probably automate the whole process, and I'll give you a way to do it automatically, but we're going to value difficult-to-value companies, troubled companies, distressed companies, young companies, commodity companies, companies that people have given up on. Then we're going to spend about 4 sessions on pricing. What did I say pricing was? You compare what you're paying for a stock to what other people are paying for similar stocks. You know what pricing looks like? There's usually a standardized price, which is a multiple, P/E ratio, EV to EBITDA, EV to sales. And there are a bunch of companies and analyst claims are just like your company. It's a complete lie. Because can you imagine you're doing a pricing of Microsoft and you claim to have found 15 companies just like Microsoft? In what universe was that? Which means if you're doing pricing right, you've got to control for differences. You've got to talk about how do we create these peer groups. So we're going to spend time on pricing and talking about using the data rather than throwing it away. Then we're going to spend a session on valuing asset-based valuation. You're saying, what is that? You value a company in pieces. So if you have a real estate company with 5 properties, you value each property separately. That's an easy case. But if you're valuing GE, you value each business separately. It's called a sum of the parts valuation. We'll talk about both sum of the parts valuation and sum of the parts pricing and how that can be different from valuing an entire company. Then we'll spend a session on valuing private business. You think only one session? The mechanics for valuing private companies is not different from valuing public companies. So we're going to talk about what's different, and there's not that much you have to do differently. You can come up with a very different value, but we'll talk about what it is that causes that difference. Then 3 sessions on perhaps the only part of valuation which you can think of as new and different, which is applying option pricing in the context of valuing a business. So we're not going to use option pricing to value a put option or a call option or a, you know, or a contingent value, right? We're going to use option pricing to value young pharmaceutical companies. Saying, where's the option there? It's a young pharmaceutical company with a new product working its way through the pipeline. It has no revenues, no earnings, no cash flows. So what determines whether you make money or not? Whether the product gets approved and becomes commercial. It's a contingent payoff. Anytime payoffs are contingent on something happening, whether you know it or not, there is an option there. So when you value an oil company and a lot of undeveloped reserves, and they're very expensive reserves to take out of the ground, right now they might be worth nothing, but there is a contingent payoff. So we're going to talk about applying. It's called real options. I think it's often overused, but we'll talk about the special places in valuation we can use. And then we're going to spend one session on valuing acquisitions. You're saying only one session? Somebody once asked me to teach an M&A class, and I said, after 30 minutes, I'll have nothing to do. Because there's nothing special about valuing a target company. There are two big words that come up that we'll have to confront. One is, what's the value of control? And the second is, what's the value of synergy? And it's not rocket science. So basically, we're going to get that nailed down. And we're going to talk about valuing acquisitions. And in session 25, I want to talk about changing value. Why would you care? You're the manager of a company. You're a private equity investor. How do you make money? You buy a company, you make changes to it, and you try to make it a more valuable company. So essentially, if your end game is consulting or private equity, that value enhancement is going to give you the tools of taking what we've done in traditional valuation and being much more active with them. So a little bit about pre-season prep. It's too late anyway, but I don't need that much. I need to understand basic accounting. And don't get too caught up in accounting. So don't pick up a 3,000-page accounting book or something. Like 20 pages summary is probably, like a Cliff Notes version is perfectly okay. I have my own Cliff Notes version that you can check. The second is basic statistics. Like what? Correlation, covariance, what's a regression? Trust me, even if you've forgotten all of it, I'll make it all come back in all its gory details. So, you know. And third, you know, if you did take corporate finance and you've completely forgotten it over the last 9 months, you know how to find the material you need. And if you did not take corporate finance from me and you want to go back and review some of this stuff, especially as we go along, you're welcome to do that as well. And as with corporate finance, I will monopolize your life for the next 15 weeks. Now, Monday after class, you will get an email about the class, right? Which you should expect about 15 minutes after the class ends. Tuesday, I will send you my valuation of the week. I've already told you what's coming next on this Tuesday. It's going to be Tesla. It's completely optional. So if you don't feel like doing it, that's okay. On Wednesday, right after the class, in my email, I'll send what's called a weekly challenge. What does that do? It takes the topic of that week and takes it one step further. Again, it's completely optional. You can do it if you want to kind of test out whether you truly understand equity risk premiums, you truly understand risk-free rates. It kind of pushes the borders on, hey, we have the facts, tell me what you'd do in this scenario. On Thursday, you will get an email about the project. You're saying, what project? I'll talk about that in a minute, but every week I will nag you. Why? Because many of you are second-year MBAs, and you have this problem of premature graduation, which is in March. You're already out of the school mentally. So I have to keep saying, no, it's not done yet. You know, you have 2 more months to go. This is where you should be on the project. On Friday, you will get a webcast about something practical. Risk meeting, risk-free rates, risk premiums. So basically, I'll take you through. That's the only time you're going to see me open a spreadsheet and go to a database and pull numbers so you can see the sausage being made in all its disgusting details. On Saturday, you get a newsletter about what we did during the week, just like in corporate financing. This is where we are in the class. And on Sunday, I'll send you the solution to the weekly challenge. Remember, it's completely optional, so don't send in your solutions. You don't have to. On Sunday, you will get the solution. You can check to see whether your solution and mine are pretty close. And if they're not, you can then ask what's different. And if you want to talk to me about the differences, that's fine. Reach class, no, not much, but no, I would like you to be here. But only if you want to. I'm not going to drag you here and take attendance. You know, we're grown-ups here, so if you feel that you can, you know, get the class on. I try as much as I can to make myself obsolete. So the classes will be online, the material will be online. But I'd like you to be here because I think this is what you paid for, is the class. This online class is going to be open to the public. So there are going to be about 10,000 people taking this class informally, because every lecture is going to be on there. You're saying, this is terrible, I paid the price, how come they get it for free? They don't get to sit in on class, but if you don't want to sit in on class, you're paying money for something that people get for free. It's your choice. And if you do miss a class, I'll make it easy for you to catch up, because you will miss classes. You're sick, you know, you have an interview, you have whatever, and life gets in the way. Your classes will be available in multiple ways. You can stream it, you can watch it on YouTube, you can watch it on iTunes U, lots of different places. There's no excuse for not keeping up with the class, even if you're physically away. You could be gone for a month and still be able to keep up with the class. I have 5 valuation books, none of them are required. Okay? So if you go to my website, I actually compare what the books do. Investment Evaluation is the only one of these books which is a textbook, which means it comes with problems and solutions. So if you like that, you can get that. But any of the other books will work as well, or none of the books. It's really, I mean, there's enough material on my website that you can get by without any books. And I told you, there's an app that will do, you know, if you have an easy valuation. If you have an Apple iPad or an iPhone, you can download UValue. It's on the Apple App Store. It comes with a money-back guarantee because it's free, which means if you don't like it, tough. You don't have to use it. But it's actually a very easy app to use. You can put them. It's like when you're stuck in an airport and instead of doing what normal people do, which is get drunk or do whatever else, you value a company. You say, oh, look, I have 20 minutes. Let me value GE right now. It'll make you look like an incredible geek, but no, if that's what you want to do, it's an iPad or an iPhone version. Almost all of the stuff you need for this class will be on that web page that I've been sending you repeatedly. You think, what about NYU classes? What about NYU classes? I start every semester with the best of intentions that I'm going to keep the NYU classes updated. I forget about 3 weeks in, and I promise you I will forget about 3 weeks in this class as well. So NYU classes is always, I'll try to put the material on, then I'll forget all about it. So almost everything you need is on my webpage. There's an iTunes U version of this class. If you have an Apple device or even an Android now, you can download the app and you can watch the whole class. Basically, it's actually a neat platform because you see the slides and the attached material. So, and it'll remind you every time a new lecture goes on. So even if you've forgotten all about the class, you get reminded saying, the lecture just went on. And there's a YouTube channel for this class alone. There's a playlist with the slides, et cetera. Google Calendar I've sent out already. That has the quiz dates, the final exam date. And the only thing that I would draw your attention to is on my blog, I do write about valuation. And since this is a valuation class and I value a company in real time, that's where you're going to see it first. As many of you know, I tweet infrequently. I use it more as, hey, look at my blog post, rather than, I'm going to change the world with my tweets. So it's kind of a reminder. And then I'm looking for numbers on my Twitter feed still. So if you have not followed me, put your email in, block me. I don't care. I just want the numbers. So I'm up to 129,000, which is not bad. And the other readings for the class, if you have time on your hands, I don't see why you would. And you say, I'd like to read more. There's a link on the site. There's a grade at the end of this class. You might not care because you're going to be graduating anyway. But you should care. If you're an F, of course, I could hold your future in my hands. I don't want to. Okay? So what I'm looking for here is how you can approach valuation. So if you can value just about anything, I should be giving you an A. If you can value most things, I'll be giving you a B or a B plus. If you can value something, well, that's better than nothing. So. If you can value nothing at the end of this class, I've really screwed up. Okay? Then I'll have to. So everything in this class is directed to me drawing that distinction. And I don't always do it correctly, but that's what I'm trying. So here's what you will see. You will see a valuation project that will run through the entire semester. Okay? Just like your corporate finance project, but here's the difference. Midway through the semester, I'm going to give you a chance to turn in your evaluation just for feedback. I won't grade it, so this is when you do your DCF evaluation, say, take a look. I'll take a look and say, maybe you want to fix this. So, you know why I do this? Is to at least put a prod on you to get that DCF done by the mid-semester. But there'll be no grade. At the end of the semester, the project is due. It is a group project, but there's actually very little group work involved. It's more of an individual project, less like, so unlike the corporate finance, we actually had to meet as a group. The reason for that is I've discovered second-year MBAs start to hate other second-year MBAs after, because you've been hanging out with these people for the last 2 years, and you don't feel like group work anymore. You'd rather lead. So I brought that into the process, limited group interaction. Maybe in the last 2 weeks, you will have to tolerate each other enough that you can get together and get that final report done. But that's 40%. There'll be three quizzes. The dates are listed there. And a final exam, which is 30%. Right now, the final exam date is May 18th, which is a bit of a pain. You know why? Because it's after the weekend. And you know your plans. Graduation is in 2 days. Unfortunately, they won't. This room is very difficult to get in. But I'll try. If I do try, some of you are going to complain that you prefer May 18th. So basically, for the moment, I'm going to try to get an option for an earlier exam for those of you who feel that you have to get out of here. But we'll work on that. We still have time. This is a rule list. You've seen it in my corporate finance class about the quizzes. There are three quizzes, each worth 10%. Somebody from my corporate finance class can help you out here. What happens if you miss a quiz? First, before you miss a quiz, what has to happen? If you decide you're going to miss quiz two, you got to let me know before the quiz, right, that you're going to miss the quiz. The reason for that is very simple. Because otherwise, you could take the quiz, and if you do badly, you slip it into your backpack and say, I wasn't there. I have no way of knowing. So in a sense, I've got to preempt that. You're saying, I'm an honest person. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the other person. No. So you have to let me know. You can email me, 1029 or 129. You say, look, I will not be there. Make up a good reason, at least. I'm not going to ask you for a doctor's note. Say, I have the coronavirus. I'm going to say, okay, you know. whatever it is, I will. But at least have the, at least, you know, don't say I wasn't ready. I don't feel like it. You know? Come up with something that sounds good, at least. But if you do miss the quiz, what happens? The 10% on the quiz gets moved to the remaining quiz and exam. Why? Because otherwise you get strategic quiz missing, right? You do really well, you want to, so it'll get moved. So you don't lose the 10%. The one thing you gain by doing all three quizzes is if you have a bad quiz, I'll replace the score on that bad quiz with the average on your remaining exams. So you get 0, 10, 10, 30, which is an extreme scenario. I'll give you 10 on the third quiz because you got 100% on your remaining exams. So there's an advantage to taking quizzes, so don't miss a quiz unless you feel you have to miss the quiz, because you don't gain anything by missing a quiz, even if you don't feel quite ready. You can bring your iPads in for the quizzes or tablets. This morning I said iPads and somebody said I have a Huawei tablet. No, can I bring it in? Any tablet. So I don't discriminate again. I should probably discriminate against Android users, but I don't. Okay? Why? Because if you're downloading the lecture notes on an iPad, your lecture notes are going to be there, your notes might be there. I don't want people printing off hundreds of pages just for the exam. So you can, but you can't use your iPad as a calculation device. You can't use Excel on it, or because that's, you know, for the moment at least, I don't allow laptops and Excel. And be thankful that I don't, because if I did, I would write a very different exam, and you might not want to see what that exam looks like. So, you know, so it's open book, open notes. You can miss quizzes, but you know, but the score will get pushed into the remaining exam. So factor that in when you decide to miss a quiz. As for group work, you create a group. You're responsible for policing that group. So unless things get really, really dire, please don't come to me and say, no, we have a group member that we want to shed like the 10th week or 11th week. What can we do? I'll ask you to watch The Godfather or Marathon Man and give you some suggestions on torture instruments that you can use. But unless it's really extreme, try to work it out yourselves. And it is true that you will be carrying some group member across the finish line. That's what happens with second years, second semester. And, you know, treat that as part of the cost of getting an MBA. On the quizzes, I will grade your quizzes. So as you know, last semester I grade the quizzes speedily, but not always correctly. I prefer speedy feedback, which is noisy, to perfect feedback that is slow. So usually you'll get the quizzes back within 24 hours or 48 hours of taking it. And if you have questions, come and see me. Don't go see the TA, the TF. They have nothing to do with the grading of the quizzes. It's all on me. And finally, in participation, all participation is welcome. Just don't turn your evil eye on somebody just because they're asking a lot of questions. It's going to be okay. I'll get through the stuff. Leave it to me, okay? So leave the policing to me. I don't want kind of mobs forming to drag this guy out and lock him in a room or something. You know, it's all going to be okay. We'll get through all the stuff we need to. So that's the syllabus. Let me very quickly hit you on the project part, and then we'll... So here's what the project is. Just like in corporate finance, each of you will pick a company, but it's much more loosely structured. Remember in corporate finance, I made you pick companies with a common theme? Nothing here. So each of you has to pick a company, which means you don't even have to wait for a group to be formed before you pick a company. What company should you pick? Pick something you're interested in. Okay? The only constraint I'm going to impose is that a group-wide constraint. Across the group, at least one company that you pick has to be money losing. At least one. At least one company has to be high growth in revenues. So basically, it could be Casper, for instance, a high growth, money losing company, lots of growth in revenues. At least one company high growth. And one company has to be a non-domestic company. It can be Brazilian. You can even cheat and make a Canadian company, which, you know, I don't think is non-domestic. It's like a natural resource company just offshore. But you can pick at least one. And I want you to value that company, if you can, in the local currency. You know what I mean, right? Don't pick an ADR, which is that company listed in the U.S. and try to play games with the ADR. I want you to... Now you're saying that's a lot of constraints. Remember, the constraint, one company can meet multiple constraints. So some of you can adopt this strategy. Pick five, you know, get a group of five together, pick five nice, easy companies. When the sixth person tries to join your group, ask them to pick a money-losing, high-growth foreign company, and it'll be over, right? But there's the trade-off here, which is picking a Kraft Heinz will mean that your valuation goes very smoothly. But you're not going to learn much about valuation. Picking a Casper is going to be challenging, but you will learn a lot more. So I'm going to give you the same advice I've always given in this class. Go where it's darkest. Find a nice Venezuelan consumer product company to value. How about a nice Ukrainian mining company? There are no nice Venezuelan consumer product companies or nice Ukrainian mining companies. Go where it's darkest. Pick a market in crisis. Pick a company in crisis. Say, I'm going to jump in there. Why? Because that's where you're going to find the biggest mistakes. Because what happens when you have a company in crisis and a market in crisis? Everybody's running, right? They're just selling and moving on. This might be your chance of a lifetime. You pick Kraft Heinz, you might value the company, but so can everybody else. As I said, the project is due in two parts. One half of the project, the discounted cash flow valuation, I'll give you feedback. So it's really not due in two halves because it's completely optional. If you don't want feedback, I'm fine with that. But it'll be, I think that's a Friday, you get it in. I will try to get it back to you by early the next week so you have a sense of, hey, everything's okay. And we don't expect feedback like your growth rate is wrong. I don't know the growth rate for every company on the face of the earth. I really don't. So here's all I'm going to point to. I'm going to say, look, your assumptions seem to be at war with each other. Is this assumption? So it's the kind of feedback that I hope you can use to make your valuation more consistent. And the entire project is due at 5 p.m. on May 11th, which is your last day of class. So here are the steps. First, pick a company. And as I said, those constraints all kick in. And don't tell me you can't find a company. Come on. There are 43,000 publicly traded companies on the face of this earth. Just pick a damn company. And don't be like Hamlet. You say, what's Hamlet got to do with this? Remember, he couldn't make up his mind. Don't say, I think, well, let me change. Just pick a company and get started. You can change that company because if you're working along with the class and you change your company in week five, you're still going to be okay. Whereas if you don't pick a company and you don't pick a company and you start in week nine, you're way behind the game. So pick a company, you can always change your mind. You don't have to tell me what company you picked, remember. So you, I don't even know what you picked in week two. All I know is what you turned in week 15. So the first part will do be when you pick the company, what you're going to do is an intrinsic valuation of your company. Fancy word for you're going to do a DCF and you're going to come up with cash flows, growth, and risk. And that's the part that's due halfway through the semester. Second, I want you to price your company. I shouldn't even use the word value there. Price your company relative to other companies. So what will this require you to do? You're trying to, you know, pick a value steel company. The first part you're going to do a DCF. The second part, let's say you pick Severstal, Russian steel company. In the second part, you have to say, is Severstal cheap or expensive relative to other steel companies? And you have to decide, are you going to compare it to other Russian steel companies? The problem there is there might be only two. Other emerging market steel companies, European steel companies, you have to make that judgment. You have to price your company. So at this stage, you're going to have a value for your company from your DCF and a pricing for your company. And as with corporate finance, I'm going to get you access to Capital IQ and give you that PDF, you know, if you've forgotten how to get on Capital IQ, because it's the easiest way for you to draw data on hundreds of companies at one go. It saves you a lot of time. Third, I'm going to ask you to price your company relative to the market. You're saying, what's this different? How is this different from step three? In step three, what did I ask you? How is Severstal price relative to other steel companies? Now I'm asking, how is Severstal price relative to the market? And there again, you have to make a decision. Is it the Russian market you want to compare it to? Is it the global market? But at this stage, you're going to have three numbers for your company: a value, a pricing relative to the sector, and a pricing relative to the market. You're saying, where is this going? You're going to see in a minute. So you're going to have three different numbers for your company: a value, two pricing. In some of your cases, you'll have a fourth number for your company, because remember we talked about real options at some of your companies as an optionality. Maybe you have a natural resource company, a distressed company, a young pharmaceutical company, and maybe you can use an option pricing model to come up with the value for your company. So now you have four different numbers for your company. Trust me, there's a place this is going. Last step, I'm going to ask you to decide. On what? There's actually only one price. You'll have four different numbers, and I'm going to ask you to tell me whether you'd buy or sell. No weaselly words like strong buy and weak buy and semi-strong sell. You either sell or buy. Some of you will be too chicken and you will hold. I try to force you off that ledge, but I can't always succeed. But I want you to buy or sell. You see the challenge you're going to face? Let's say you value your company at 50. Stocks at 35. So your valuation says it's undervalued. Then you price your company and you get 20. Your pricing says it's overpriced. What do you have to decide? Whether you're buying or selling. You're saying, which one should I go with? That's your choice to make. And you know what you're going to base it on? How much trust do I have in these numbers? And some of you might decide the pricing is the number you trust more. Some of you might decide the valuation. I'm not going to push you into one or the other, because it's your choice and technically it's your money if you're actually buying these shares. So this class is about valuing and pricing with an action at the end. It's not about just valuing and pricing and leaving the numbers. Okay? And at the end of the class, I'll show you what buy recommendations on this class have done over the 32 years that I've been tracking the buys and the sells of this class. So you can see, you know, whether we should be running a mutual fund in the first place. Okay. So that's a project, and I want you to think about starting on it. I know we have 6 minutes. I hate wasting time. So I'm going to start on the introduction to valuation. You said, I'm done with it. And if you picked up the third packet, bring it to the front, because what I want to talk about now is setting the table for the entire class. So for this rest of this session, going through Wednesday, what I will do is talk about what's valuation, what's pricing, what's real options from a very big picture perspective. When I first started teaching this class, I made the mistake of assuming that everybody else was as interested in valuation as I was. And it turned out to be a very bad assumption. Because I've discovered that most people don't believe in valuation. And I include most people who do valuation for a living. Their heart's not in it. They do it because it's their job. They do it because they're supposed to, they want to cover their rear ends. They don't believe in valuation. If I didn't believe in valuation. I couldn't teach this class. So I'm going to tell you why I do valuation. I do valuation to fight the lemming in me. You heard of lemmings? Lemmings became famous or infamous in the 1950s. When National Geographic or Disney, the story is a little murky as to who created the story, filmed the most amazing sight. Thousands of big, ugly, rat-like creatures, that's what lemmings look like, gathered together on a cliff, ran right off the cliff into an ocean and committed collective suicide. And ever since, one of those big questions, why do they do it? What drives them off the cliff? I don't know the answer to that question, but let's do some virtual imagery. You can see why the first lemming did it, right? He's going too fast, he couldn't stop, went right off the cliff into the ocean. Incidentally, these guys can't swim. Let me pull up the slides there. It's the wrong slides, but let's get started at least. The second lemming is going too close. The first guy couldn't stop either. I want you to put yourself in the shoes of the very last lemming in that group. I know lemmings don't wear shoes, but kind of hang in there with the analogy anyway. You're running as fast as you can towards a cliff. You've seen your entire tribe disappear off that cliff. I would assume you'd have second thoughts about what you were just planning to do. Your left brain, right brain, whatever part's rational, saying, stop, 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 don't do it. And then you hear this voice in the back of your head. You know what it's saying? They must know something that you don't. Remember those seven words. They're the seven most deadly words in investing and valuation. They must know something that you don't. I'll tell you when you hear it. Let's pick a stock. Tesla, 640. 650 today, probably. 660 now? 700. There you go. Yeah, I've already lost $60 since Thursday. Right? Now you remind me. Okay? Over 700. You sit down to value Tesla, you come up with 250. What's your rational side saying? Don't buy that stock. And then there's this voice in the back of your head. They must know something that you don't. It speaks in a monotone. Don't ask me why. And when you hear that voice, magical things start to happen to your valuation. Your growth rates start to get higher. Your discount rates get lower. Your value goes from 250 to 300. It's almost like your spreadsheet took on a mind of its own. It's moving towards 700. Don't fight it. There's a lemming inside each and every one of you dying to get out. Let it out. In fact, you can divide the whole world of investors into three groups of lemmings. The first group I call proud lemmings. I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. They call themselves momentum investors. But it's pretty much the same thing, right? What do? They look for a crowd. They join in. You're buying. I'm buying. You're selling. I'm selling. Why are you buying? I don't care. I can't pull off being a proud lemming. The second group of lemmings I call Yogi Bear lemmings. Yogi Bear comics. You're smarter than the average bear. Yogi Bear lemmings think they're smarter than the average lemming. You know what they want to do? They want to run with the crowd to the very edge of the cliff. And the last moment, veer away. Great if you can pull it off. You get all the upside of momentum. And none of the downside. Admit it, you're tempted. You're saying, I don't know, I'm stern, I'm smarter than the average person. No, I know where the cliff is coming. You might be, but I'm not. I am not smarter than the average lemming. I have no idea where the cliff is. If you ask me to describe myself, that's me. A lemming with a life vest. That's all I aspire to be. That's all valuation throws to me. Because remember, it's human nature to be a lemming. Why? Because that's how we've survived. Can you imagine being a contrarian cave person? Your entire tribe comes running towards you. You run in the opposite direction. 99 times out of 100, what happened to you? You got stomped by that mammoth that was chasing them down. There's a reason we panic with everybody else. I'm human. I'm going to be part of the crowd. Valuation throws a life vest to me. So look, even if everybody else changes their mind, here, hold on to these cash flows. Sometimes it's not enough, but that's why I do valuation. It's not going to make me rational. It's not going to make me like a machine. It's essentially going to give me a chance, my rational side, a chance to mount an argument. So when we start on Wednesday, we're going to go into what I call the Bermuda Triangle of valuation.